All right, we're ready for Genesis chapters 5 to 7 in our study tonight. And we're going to begin by looking at our outline of the book of Genesis. It'll be up in just a moment. But anyway, we're looking at three major points in our outline, or two major points. There's the early history in chapters 1 through 11, and that's where we are. In chapter 5 through 7, or 5 through 9, is going to deal with the flood. And that's where we are. We'll be in that story of the flood until next time. And so chapters 8 and 9 deal with that as well. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1, quickly, was about what? 6 days of creation. Chapter 2, man in the garden. Chapter 3 was fall of man, Adam and Eve's sin. And chapter 4, Cain and Abel. All right, we won't do that every time in interest of time, but hopefully we can keep up with that. Let's go to Genesis 5. I don't have an outline of Genesis 5 because it is a genealogy. And so I want to say several things about this genealogy. We're not going to read through every word of this. Hopefully you have read through Genesis 5. It's a very important chapter, though it's a difficult at times to read because of the names, perhaps. The ages add up to 1656 years from Adam to the flood. And we'll say more about that in a moment, how we arrive at that. It deals with 10 generations that are literal generations, as we're going to see from Jude in just a second. Let's talk about a little bit about the purpose of this genealogy here. It's not just an interesting genealogy, but there's a purpose. It's linear and not segmented. What we mean by that, there is a segmented section right at the end, but segmented genealogy has to do with spreading out, and this man had so many different sons, and then they had so many different sons, so it spread across to identify who's kin to who. That's not the purpose of this genealogy. The purpose of this genealogy here is linear, that is, it links the last entry, which is Noah, to the first entry, which is Adam. And there's a purpose in that. And so that we know how far it was from Adam down to Noah and the flood, and also that is part of the lineage of Christ, as we're going to see in Luke 3. So that's important. We'll get to that here in just a second. Now, this chronology from Adam to the flood, this is taken from Willis's commentary. Many of you may be looking at his big, large two-volume set on Genesis that just came out last year, and it's an excellent work. But this little chart's taken from that, which to me puts this kind of in perspective. You have the man on the one side, and the center column is the age he was at the birth of his son. And then in the third column has to do with the age of the earth at the birth of his son. And so you have, for example, Adam, and then you have Seth and Enos and Canaan and so on down the line. But what we're interested in right here, and you might want to make a note of this, at the end of chapter 5, that this totals up 1,656 years. Now, is that 1,656 literal years? Yes. And I'll tell you why that's the case in just a moment. Now, I want to go back to this right here. This is not a condensed genealogy. Some have speculated this is a condensed genealogy, meaning that there are several generations that must have been skipped. Genealogies sometimes do that. Evidence, Matthew 1, skipped three generations there in one skip. And we noted that in Matthew chapter 1. And so the purpose of that kind of genealogy is just simply to see this one is the descendant of that one. But is this one a literal 10 generations? Well, Jude 14 says that Enoch was the seventh from Adam. Well, you count, starting with Adam is one, count down your seven and you come to Enoch. Well, it's unlikely that the rest of those are not literal generations and consecutive generations if the first seven are. So Jude 14 gives us some insight to that. And so we're looking at, and you might make again a marginal note, and our purpose, at least mine is, to make a note of that. I want to kind of keep up how long has it been since some other Bible event. We're only five chapters in, and we've already covered some 1,600 years. So that's a pretty good hunk of time that we've covered, and more about that here in just a moment. So Genesis 1 starts with Adam, and notice the cross. It's on the person here. That's identifying the lineage of Christ. And so you start with Adam, and they had Cain and Abel and Seth and other children. So it's through Seth that we're interested in this genealogy in Enosh. And so then you go from Enosh on all the way down to Canaan, again, indicating the lineage of Christ. And that's indicated in Luke 3. Now, Matthew traces his lineage back to Abraham, where in Luke 3 it's traced back to Adam. Make sense? All right. So that's why this chapter is important to us. One of the reasons why this chapter is important. We've got to say something about the ages of the people. That has startled some Bible students, including some Christians, who argue these ages cannot be correct. No one ever lived to be 969 years of age. This is just impossible. But I want to suggest to you that there is a decreasing lifespan that all of the students allude to as they work through the book of Genesis. This again is from Willis's work. He says, the Old Testament presents a decreasing lifespan that may be roughly summarized as follows, and then I created this little graph to illustrate what he was saying. That from Adam to Lamech, who is Noah's father, the lifespan generally was 1,000 to 800 years. Now, the oldest that we know of was Methuselah, who was 969. So, but we're just looking at rough numbers. So from 1,000 to 800 years would be the lifespan during that time. But from Noah to Abraham, it was reduced down to 600 to 200 as you trace the ages. And then from Adam to Moses, it was reduced from 200 down to 100. You see the decreasing lifespan? By Psalm 90, there was mentioning that the lifespan of 70 to 80 years. Quite a drastic change. Now, why is that? Well, more about that here in just a second. I think we need to pay attention to whether or not the ages are correct or not. And what do we know about that? And the major argument that's made against that. And so let's talk about that just for a moment. Some students, even among Christians who go through these ages, this can't be, this has got to be an inflated, exaggerated age. No one lives to be that long, is the idea. This is from this book, Biblical Numerology. If you're interested in numbers scattered throughout the Bible, I recommend that's an excellent book. But John Davis, he said on page 57, starting on 57, going into 58, there is no reason for rejecting the ages of the antediluvian patriarchs as both unreasonable and impossible. The drastic drop in longevity may be explained on sound scientific grounds. And for those of you wanting to do further study, there's a footnote there that refers to Henry Morris's The Genesis Flood, page 404. He gives a number of things that he talks about on page 404 that you can copy that or I can reference that for you later on. From a scientific standpoint, what may have happened from a scientific standpoint. But he goes further to say, and it may have been due to God's judicial dealing with mankind in the flood, and he quotes from H.C. Leupold, who says, he who is duly impressed with the excellence of man's original state will have no difficulty in accepting the common explanation that under the curse of sin, man's constitution displayed such vitality that it did not at first submit to the ravages of time until after centuries had passed. Well, he's got a point about that. And Morris makes similar points in the Genesis Flood, page 404. I can't leave Genesis 5 without talking about, are these ages correct then, and the major argument that's made. One of the most common arguments, and I cite again biblical numerology because he suggests this is the biggest argument he sees, that these are not literal days, literal years. That the years stand for months. And so Methuselah, who lived 969 years, that would translate to 80 years. Well, then that makes sense, doesn't it? Until we try that on for size with some others. Now, what's interesting is those who are critics of the Bible are never satisfied with God's word. When God says the world was created in 6 days, they make the days longer, like millions of years. And then when it says someone lived 969 years, they make that shorter. So they take one thing, make it longer, another thing, make it shorter, rather than taking God at his word. But as one of the polemics said a number of years ago, he said, let's try this on for size now and see how this works. Seth was 105 years when Enosh was born. Let's translate that to months. He would have been less than 9 years old when his son was born. That doesn't work too well. Well, that's not the worst of it, because there are two others that were less than 6 years old. Not quite 6 years old when they had sons. So that doesn't work too well. And so that's not what Genesis 5 is about. Does that make sense? All right. So we take God at his word, 6 literal days in Genesis 1, 969 literal years in Genesis chapter 5. Now, that gets us up to the day of the flood now in Noah, so we've come 1,600 years or more, nearly 1,700 years. All right? Now let's go to Genesis chapter 6. And I'm not taking the time to answer all of our questions. I'll try to flag the ones that we get to. Question number 2 we just answered, which is 1,656 years. And so, anyway, let's go to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6 is about what? All right. We saw corruption starting in chapter 4 with the descendants of Cain. Remember that? And through his lineage, things were not going well. Things were going quite south. So here's what happens in Genesis 6. You have the reason and the preparation for the flood. Let's start with the reason. Verses 1 to 13. This is a very familiar story. And so beginning at verse 1 through verse 7, and then we'll jump down to 13. I'm kind of separating this out, and you'll see why in a moment. This is describing how wicked the world had become. Verse 1 talks about man began to multiply on the face of the earth. And the sons of God saw daughters of men, and they were beautiful. Well, there's a couple of things to say about that. One, some suggest they were marrying solely on the basis of beauty, which doesn't make for a solid marriage. But I'm not sure that's the point as much as it is that the sons of God saw the daughters of men. Some think the sons of God have reference to angels. There's no evidence of that. Angels could not marry. Luke chapter 20. So that's not talking about angels at all. I take it that the sons of God had reference to those who are righteous, and the sons of men or the daughters of men would be those of the world, or those who are wicked, those who are not righteous and not living in harmony with God. Verse 3, I want to come back to in a little bit. We'll put that in our second category, that God planned to destroy the earth. But verse 4 says that there were giants in the earth. Now, if you read from the King James, New King James, you have that. If you're reading from one of the other translations, you will see, or in your footnote, you'll see Nephilim. And so if you have that in your Bible, then look at your footnote, and it's going to say giants. Well, that helped a lot. So what is that? Well, the word is not the idea of a giant in the sense of a humongous person. It had reference to those who were rebels and apostates, Gesenius. Gesenius is to the Hebrew what Thayer is to the Greek. He's a lexicographer. Those who are fallers, in other words, those who are fallen. In other words, outcast, rebels, who lived wild lives. That's the idea. Tyrants, Colin Dalich would say, who fell upon people. They're fallen in their character, but they fall on people. Not literally fall, but they make people prey. So there were giants. In other words, corrupt people is the idea. And when the sons of God came to the daughters of men, they bore children, and they were mighty men, men of renown. And so they're multiplying and keep multiplying. And as they multiply, people are becoming corrupt and becoming more corrupt, and even more corrupt is the idea that's going on. What does God say at verse 5? All right. The wickedness on the earth was great, and that every intent of his heart, we have a question on that, I think. Yeah, question 3. Every intent of his heart, always on evil, continually doing evil. That all he thinks about is doing wrong. All he thinks about is doing evil. All he thinks about is sinning. So man is quite corrupt. To the degree that God's attitude was, verse 6. Yeah, he's ready to destroy the earth. Now let's drop down to verse 11. We're still developing idea how wicked the world was. The earth was so corrupt, it was filled with violence. Which, by the way, verse 11 is one verse, and then that would give me a commentary on the idea of the giants. They are corrupt people connected with this violence that the earth is filled with. But the earth is filled with violence, verse 11, and it was corrupt, etc. And God said he's going to make an end of all the flesh. Now, I want to look at verse 3, 7, and 13. Because the world is so corrupt, God said, I'm ready to destroy it. I wished I had not made man. He relented him that he had made man. He says he's going to destroy the world. So verse 3 is 1. And what does he say at verse 3?
The Spirit
shall not abide in man forever. How long does he give man? 120 years. You might make a marginal note. What took place during the 120 years? All right, built the ark, and he did some preaching. It's a preaching I'm interested in because we're going to see in this context that he built the ark. That's going to be obvious from this context. But what's not obvious from this context may be as clearly as from 1 Peter chapter 3 and 20 and 2 Peter 2, 5. Those two verses, I'll give those again in a second. Might make it a margin note. What took place in 120 years? He's preaching to the people. He's a preacher of righteousness. 2 Peter 2, 5, 1 Peter 3, 20. 2 Peter 2, 5, 1 Peter 3, 20. All right. Now, verse 7 is another verse where God says he plans to destroy the earth, both creeping things, beast and man, and birds of the air. I'm sorry that I've made man. Then verse 13, that I will destroy them from the earth. So God's plan, I'm going to destroy. This is what I'm going to do. Now, 8 through 10, what do we read about Noah? Noah found grace. Yeah, and favor. Remember, we talked about that passage when we talked about grace. Some say there's no grace in the Old Testament. Well, right here, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And so he was perfect, meaning that he was blameless. That's not flawless, but blameless. And he walked with God, he and his three sons. And so God is going to preserve them. So that's the wickedness of man. Now let's talk about the instructions to build the ark, beginning at verse 14. So let's go to question number 4. What was the size and the dimensions of the ark? First, the kind of wood. What was he to make it of? Gopher wood. All right. What else do we know about the size then?
35 feet wide.
All right. We'll get those dimensions again in a moment, but suffice it for now, if you don't have your answer to your question, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. We'll get those again if you didn't catch that. All right, that's the size of the ark. That gets us through verse 15. Now, verse 16, we have a little question here about the window. You see pictures of the ark, and you'll see some that I'm going to post, and you say, whoa, that's not correct, because that's not the idea I've got of a window. And a little later, by the way, chapter 8, we'll get into this next time. Let me make sure I got the right verse. Verse 6, Noah opened the window. Different word. It's not the same word that we have in our text. So I'm not sure. I'm not saying I'm 100% sure that it's not, but I'm not sure that's the same window that was in chapter 6 and in verse 16. And I'll tell you why in a minute. But it's a different word in the Hebrew. So you say, well, I know it was a window he could open because he opened it. That's a different word over here. We'll get to that next time. But anyway, there's this window. Your translation may not use the word window. It may say roof, and that's a correct translation of that. And so is window a correct translation of that. It can be translated window. It can be translated roof. And so there's some discussion. Does this have reference to an upper portion let's see. It was a cubit, which is 18 inches. Above. And so it's a little obscure as to what did that describe. Some think that described a roof that hung out, had an overhang of a cubic on each side. And others think that it stood up, and I'll show you a picture of that in a moment, which is the more common thought, that it stood up and there was ventilation at the top so that there was a roof and there was a ventilation panels along the side because of all of the animals, etc. And that may be this window, this roof or window. Not the same as chapter 8 that Noah opened. We'll get to that next time. I'm just trying to flag that before you jump over there and say, whoa, wait a minute. Chapter 8 is going to give us some insight. All right. Now, let's go to verses 17 and 18. The ark was to save Noah and his family I want to finish this chapter, and then I want us to look at some things about the ark itself before we get to chapter 7. What do you see in 17, 18, and 19? 17, 18. All right. Yeah, in verse 17 and 18, you have Noah and his sons and his and Noah's wife and his sons' wives. And we know how many are identified later in 1 Peter. How many? Eight souls were saved, the text says, by water. All right. Now, 19 to 22, we'll see more about this in chapter 7, about clean and unclean. I'll comment on that later. But what do we have in 19 to 22? It was the instructions for him. All right. Yeah, here's the provision for bringing the animals in that was bring them in two by two. And they're going to take food in for you, and you're going to take food in for these animals. And that's going to take care of getting the animals in that they may be preserved. Now, I'm most interested in verse 22. One of the most fascinating phrases is at the last three words, at least in my translation, that Noah did all according to all that God commanded him, and so he did. Yeah. Could that be said of any commandment that is said about you or about me? So he did or so she did. This is all that God commanded, so he did. That's a powerful phrase. All right, let's talk about the size of the ark to get a perspective of that. It was 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. For some of you, that's you got a mental picture immediately. Others of you don't have a clue what 450 feet is. So 450 feet long is a football field and a half. That's pretty long, to give you a perspective. The width of it is 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. 45 feet high is an average four-and-a-half-story building. Let me give you another perspective. From the ground, not from where I'm standing, but the ground below this, if I remember correctly, no, it's from where I'm standing. From here to the crown of this building is 45 feet. So if you go outside and look from the ground to the crown, that's 45 feet. That's pretty tall. This auditorium, this is from the blueprints of this original blueprints that have been altered since then. It's 76 feet from that wall through the classroom to the wall at the other end of the classroom. So that's how wide this ark is. 45 feet tall, 75 feet wide. The total deck space would be equivalent to 20 basketball courts. It would hold as much, and this is mentioned by numerous writers who've repeated this, it could hold the same as 520 boxcars, railroad cars is what I mean by boxcar. That's huge capacity. We're beginning to get a feel for how, some of you have been to the Ark Encounter, I haven't yet, but you kind of get the feel of how big, how humongous the Ark is. Here is a 1/75th scale model, and that is one of Columbus's ship next to it, and there's a boxcar next to it to give you kind of a comparison of the size of that. There were three decks. We kind of skipped over that section. Notice at verse 16, there was a lower, second, and third deck. Exactly what they look like, we don't know. But here's a cutaway version of that that may give us an impression of that. Now, here's where I was talking about the window. Our roof may have been something like this. Do I know for sure? No. But the word for roof here is not, again, the same we find over concerning the window in chapter 8. It very well may have been ventilation at the top. Very well may have been, which would seem to fit the Hebrew word here, and at least harmonize with it. I'm not saying that that's the only explanation that fits that word. I'm just simply saying it harmonizes with the idea of a roof. Making sense? Kind of give you a perspective of the size of the ark. All right, let's go to chapter 7 now. We want to say more about the flood at the end of chapter 7. What's chapter 7 about? All right, the world is being destroyed by a flood. This is the flood itself. So we have three things that happen in chapter 7. God shuts Noah and his family, all the animals in the ark, verses 1 to 16, and then we see the flood itself. And I've kind of separated that out, pulled verse 4 and verse verse 20, one out of one section, one out of the other that describes the flood. So let's go through 1 through 16 first. God shut them up in the ark. Now, God told him to come into the ark, and he was to take with him seven. Now, we don't have that information in chapter 6. But in chapter 7, they were to take seven of every clean animal, male and female, to each of animals that are unclean, male and female. So what was the purpose of having some of seven and the clean and unclean? I take it that was for sacrifice when they came off of the ark. Chapter 8 is going to talk about that, verses 20 to 22. And I take it that that was for the sacrifices when they come off. It's not spelled out here, but that's some degree of conjecture. What else do we see in verses 1 through 16 that we need to know about? Verse 5 makes similar points that we saw in 6 and 22, that Noah did all that was commanded. Verse 6, you might flag that he was how old when the floods came upon the earth? 600 years old. Verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, then all the fountains of the deep were broken up. That's when the flood started. All right? All right, still working our way down through verse 16. How long did it rain on the earth? Verse 12. 40 days and 40 nights. And that very same day, Noah and his sons and Shem and Ham and Japheth and their wives entered into the ark. And they took the animals therein, verse 14. They went into the ark two by two, etc. Verse 16, they entered the ark and all the flesh, and the Lord shut them in. So just as God had said, they take all the animals in, they take their families in, and God shuts them up in the ark. Heard someone speaking on the flood, made a point I hadn't thought about, and I think maybe it's true. He made the point that the wonder is not that the world did not believe Noah, but that Noah believed God, because he had never seen a flood before. He had never seen rain like this before. And to tell him you need to be in the ark and save all of these animals because there's going to be a flood, something he's never understood or seen before, experienced before. It's not like, well, I remember that last flood, and I better get building. And he'd never seen. That takes faith. We talk about the faith of Abraham. That took a lot of faith. Say, I'm going to build an ark because there's going to be a flood. And warn people that if you don't do right, you're going to lose your soul in the flood. What flood? Never heard of a flood before. That's interesting. All right. Now let's look at two verses in the middle here, and that is verse 4 and verse 20 that describe the flood. Verse 4 we've already flagged. One similar to that at verse 12. Let's go back to verse 4, that after he'd been in the ark 40 days and 40 nights, for 40 days and 40 nights I will destroy the face of the earth. So it's going to rain for 40 days and 40 nights. You might put verse 4 and verse 12 there if you're copying that. Well, how deep was the flood? Verse 20. That's 22 and a half feet. Now, I take it... because of the terrain, that doesn't mean that it's 22 feet everywhere you could measure the water. I take it from the highest hill or from the highest mountain, it was 22 feet above that, is what I'm taking the passage to mean. So 22 and a half feet. So how much is 22 and a half feet? I think we are 13, 14 feet from right here to the ceiling. So you can do the math and add a few more feet to that. That's a lot of water above the top of the mountains. Anyway, let's get the last section, and then I think we've got time to talk about some other things on the flood. Questions on the flood itself or shutting Noah in before we talk about all flesh dying in the flood? I'm pushing to get through. I want to talk about whether this was a universal flood and deal with a little chronology if we can, if we have time. So let's talk about this right here, this last section, 17 to 24. What we have is all flesh dying in the flood. And so the flood was on the earth for 40 days. The text says the water prevailed, tells us how high the water prevailed in verse 20, 21. And here's our key verse. Verse 21 says that all the flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps, and every man in whose nostrils was the breath and the spirit of life. And all that was on the dry land died. So he destroyed all living things, just as God had said he would. And only, I'm reading at the end of verse 23, only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the water prevailed on the earth 150 days. That's about 5 months. So there's your answer to some of the questions that we had here, which were question five. How long was the instructions? 120 years. How long did it rain? We've mentioned 40 days, 40 nights. The third point, C, water was on the earth for 150 days. And we didn't answer this one yet. Noah and his family were in the ark. How long? That's really answered a little later. 1 year and how long? 1 year and 17 days. 1 year and 17 days they were in there. We'll see more about that next time. All right. Now, I know we hurriedly got through that, but I want to get to this right here. There is much discussion, and I think this is real important here. And this is one reason that we started Genesis now versus putting it off another year, because we have in March planned for Josh Gertler, Dr. Gertler, member of the church who is a biologist. He's going to be dealing with evolution in March as he's here with us for a weekend meeting. And we kind of wanted the background of Genesis to be playing behind us closely as he comes in to deal with that. One of the things that's under attack in Genesis, not only the days of Genesis 1, which we've dealt with, and I'm sure he will deal with as well, but this flood. The flood is an enemy of the evolutionist. You can't believe in the flood as the text reveals it and believe in evolution. They don't mesh. So this has been under attack, and we'll look at that in a moment. But one of the things that's been said is that the flood was a local flood. It was not a universal flood. That's a common argument that's made by the evolutionist, by the theistic evolutionist. And some of our brethren have toyed with that a little bit. Could this have been a local flood? Well, let's play with that just a little bit. You might want to make a marginal note. I've got marginal notes in the front of my Bible about this being a local flood or universal flood, so that when I get in contact with somebody and I don't have my notes with me, I can get my Bible and show this was not a local flood. Here's why. Chapter 8, verse 9. The water was on the face of the whole earth, the text says. 6 and 7, we've already noted these following verses. Man, it destroyed man from the earth. Now, if this was a local flood, there would be areas where man could have survived. Chapter 6, 13, God destroyed all flesh with the earth. 6 and 17, every living thing in the earth was destroyed. Chapter 7, verse 4, he would destroy all from the face of the earth. All high hills were under the heavens, were covered. Chapter 7, verse 19, every creeping thing and every man, not most men, but every man and every creeping thing. And then chapter 9, we haven't got to yet, the rainbow argues for a universal flood. More about that here in a second. What I'm suggesting to you is there's abundant evidence right here in the text. I don't have to be scientific and say, well, here is some evidence we found. Just look at the text, and the text says this was a universal flood. Now, if this was a local flood, the question is, why have Noah to build an ark? Why build an ark if this is a local flood? Why not have Noah and the animals to migrate to higher ground? If there's going to be a flood in the region where Noah lived, why not go to a higher ground? He had 120 years to move. He could have gone anywhere in 120 years. If so, why the promise in a rainbow? Why did God make a promise in a rainbow if this was a local flood? If so, if it was a local flood, then God's purpose of destruction of every living creature was not accomplished, because there had to be creatures that were on higher ground that were not destroyed. And furthermore, if this is a powerful point, if the promise of the rainbow was that God would never do this again, God lied to us, because he did it again. Because there have been local floods time and time and time and time again. Major floods time and time again. So if evolution be true, and you can convince me that this was just a local flood, then my God lied to me. My God lied to me, because he said he would never do that again. And so this has to be a universal flood. Does that make sense? This is not some kind of local flood. Now, what's the importance of us getting it right on the flood? And so this is not just an interesting story we tell the kids in class. Oh, remember the story of Noah and the flood? And here they put the ark, put the animals two by two in the ark. And, oh, this is a neat little story. This is an important story in our faith. This author says the existence of the flood is denied by evolutionists, not so much for lack of evidence as because of the necessity of keeping to strict uniformitarianism. We'll talk about what that is in a minute. In order to provide more time for evolution. If the flood is true, evolution is false. How so? Well, here's the contrast. There are two models for the geological record. How were these rocks formed? The evolutionists argue for uniformitarianism. That is, there has been uniformity all through time, and all things were formed gradually over billions of years. So you see a rock formation and various layers and fossils that happened over millions of years. There is no such thing as a sudden catastrophic event. But catastrophism is... It argues for a worldwide flood, something that was cataclysmic, a sudden burial and rapid sediment, so that much of what we find in the geological record is explained by the flood and not by billions of years. That makes sense? That's why they can't have the flood. That's why they can't believe in the flood. That's why the flood's important to us in our faith. That's why when the flood is under attack by your child's teacher or your child's professor, or the television program your child watches, that we're in danger. That's why. It makes a big difference. The flood is incompatible with evolution. This is from Bert Thompson from Apologetics Press. He said, it would be difficult to find an account from any period of biblical history that has been more ridiculed more frequently or with greater derisiveness than the story of the flood. I say amen to that. Such a response from those who do not believe in God hardly is surprising, since by all accounts, the concept of a recent global flood, and in comparison to the evolution, that is a recent flood, is incompatible with the naturalistic system of origin espoused by the unbelievers. For more than 100 years, the flood has been under accelerated attack by infidels within the scientific community who have chosen to support such concepts as uniformitarianism and organic evolution. In fact, atheistic writers have admitted that one of the main forces behind the rise of uniformitarianism was the desire to eliminate God as the creator and the initiator of the great flood. In other words, why is there more emphasis being given to this uniformitarianism? It's the idea of let's get rid of God and God being behind the flood. Because if we can do that, we're beginning to make some inroads on evolution. Does that make sense? So this story and getting it right has everything to do with our faith. Everything to do with the foundation of our faith. Questions, comments? Big Bang.
So that's catastrophic.
Yeah. Happened with the Big Bang. No one says that all air is inconsistent. And so evolutionists and atheism is inconsistent. They've got gaps. They've got holes in their positions. But that doesn't keep them from arguing it. And so, yeah, there's gaps there. But yeah, it started with a Big Bang. Something had to happen that was catastrophic to start it all. Questions? Yes. We mentioned here recently, and that's a good point Larry's making. We mentioned here recently on a Sunday night, talking about answering error. Almost all error starts with assumptions. And the assumption that we know the date, how old these rocks are, is based on an assumption that of uniformitarianism, that this all happened over millions of years. We start with the assumption that we're trying to prove to come up with the date of the rocks. And so they're starting with that assumption. We know these rocks are millions. No, we don't know that. We don't know that. We do not know that. Questions? All right. Let's take a look at this, starting at this. I'm not going to finish this for a couple of reasons. One is we haven't got to chapter 8 and 9. I like what Wiersbe's done right here in his outlines of the Old Testament. He puts a chronology together based on the text itself. And for example, let's go to 7 and verse 4. And this gets in my mind, kind of gives me a perspective that chapter 7 and verse 4 talks about that after seven more days, he's going to enter into the ark. And that was mentioned as, I lost my place here, the month that that took place, right here, in the 600th year, verse 11, and in the second month and 17th day of the month, etc. Okay, based on that, translate that. I'm not saying that the second month and 10th day corresponds to our February, but let's just, for emphasis, to get a feel of how long they were in the ark, say he entered the ark February the 10th. The rains didn't start until February the 17th, so he's in the ark for a week. And then the rains stop on March 26th. So you think you went in February the 10th and March 26th, the rain stopped. That's 40 days. Make sense? And then it's not until July the 17th that the ark comes to rest on Mount Ararat. We'll get to that next week. We'll finish this chronology a little bit later. But what I'm wanting you to see, it's not until the following February the 27th, so that's a year and 17 days they left the ark. So they're in the ark for a year and 17 days. Does that make sense? Talk about raining for 40 days and 40 nights. Some may have the impression they were in the ark for about 40 days and then they got out. No, they were in the ark for over a year. For over a year. And so this helps me. I've got that written in the margin of my Bible to kind of get a perspective how long that was from February. And you think he didn't send the raven and the dove out till November the same year. Again, I'm not saying that the 11th month corresponds with our November. I'm just mentioning that for us to get a feel of the time frames. That make sense? All right. Let's go to our last question. We have time for one or two of these, and then our time's going to be done. Practical things you learn right here from Genesis 5 to 7 you take home with you. Good point. Good point. All the corruption around, and yet he raised three righteous people, three righteous sons. Good point. If Noah could do that in that corrupt society, we can raise our kids in this society. Good point. Yeah, it's got to get the water up there to get it that high. Yeah, a lot quicker. Yeah. That's a lot. A lot of water. What else practical you take home with you? He did. It was a monumental task. You think of the two tasks he had. One, and I know he had 120 years, but building this humongous ark. This was no small task to build. And then he had the job of trying to preach to the people. And then he's got to maintain his family, as was just mentioned. And so he can't neglect his family. He's got to build the ark, and he's got to preach to the ungodly. What a task he had. What a task he had. What else practical you take home with you? Let's get one more. Say again. Good point. Very patient God. Not only did he not destroy all of mankind, but he gave them 120 years before he destroyed. That seemed like a long time to me, but again, with the Lord, one day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years is one day. So the Lord was very patient. Larry?
I still think this is also showing God's promise to be kept. Noah was referred to, you know, had this over the hill. I was just there as a promise. As we're seeing the fulfillment of the promise, that God may regret it, he may, that this is what is going to happen. We're seeing a fulfillment of that promise.
Good point. Yeah. Had God utterly destroyed all of mankind, that promise of Genesis 3 would never have been fulfilled. And so this is God fulfilling his promise right here. Good point. We're going to stop right there.